Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin, it's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin. It's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
On the surface, everything seemed normal. But what does normal exactly mean? Could the normal going on behind the scenes for one family lead to the disappearance and death of a wife? Only to later lead to a father killing his two young sons and then himself. Just what kind of normal was this? Today, the disappearance of Susan Powell on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Susan Cox Powell is an American missing person from West Valley City, Utah, whose disappearance and presumed murder, as well as the subsequent investigation and events, garnered significant media attention. Her husband, Joshua Powell, was named a person of interest in the investigation into her disappearance, but was never charged. On February 5th, 2012, Joshua killed himself and their two young sons, Charles Joshua and Braden Timothy, in a murder-suicide after custody of the boys had been awarded to Susan's parents, Charles and Judy Cox. On May 21, 2013, West Valley City Police closed their investigation into Susan's disappearance, stating that they believe Joshua murdered her and that his brother Michael had assisted him in concealing her body. Since then, there have been repeated attempts to have Susan legally declared dead. So here we go. It's the dark side of Wikipedia, and we're going to jump into this case, the disappearance of Susan Powell. You may have read about it, seen it on several documentaries, news magazines, and such like that. And it's a very, you know, interesting, dark case. It's one of those where these sort of things, these stories almost, they strike home more than others that are, you know, massive disaster in nature and serial killer and such, because a lot of these type of stories, they feel like on the surface, when you learn about the people, you're like, oh, that could have been the people I know from down the road, or that could be my aunt and uncle, or that could be this or that, because on the surface, there seems to be this level of normalcy. And then deep down, what is that normal for some people? It's very much abnormal when you compare it to the average rest of the world. Tony and Sean joining you on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening to our podcast. So yeah, another happy story today, Sean.
A family favorite, really, Tony. But it's funny you mentioned that. Excuse me, funny is not the correct word. It is so true that you mentioned that, is many of the stories we talk about seem so far-fetched or whether it happens in a different country or in a different time, and you have zero relatability, this is something that we could see this family at the grocery store. They could live next to us in our subdivision. We could see the mom at soccer practice. It's all too often where we don't try, but we almost subconsciously or unconsciously compare our happiness, compare our family to others. And we see the mom and dad with the two kids and the golden retriever and the two SUVs in the driveway with the white picket fence, and they have the perfect family. But all too often, what appears on the surface perfect, there are deeper issues, there are deeper, darker problems than happening to others who on the surface level look like they're going through a tough time. Maybe somebody lost their house, maybe we're driving a crappy car, maybe we're having four jobs. But on the inside, we have that love, we have that comfort, we have that reassurance that, oh yeah, somebody wouldn't go missing. And then years later, the husband kills the children and kills himself.
Yeah.
Because clearly there was a lot going on. So this is, it's a little bit more chilling, I think, when we find more about this story, because we feel as though it could happen or might be happening to our neighbor.
And that's the scary thing where, I mean, obviously, statistically, odds are that this is not going down on in every subdivision and in every part of the country. But the fact that it can happen and that it has happened in one place, it makes it that much more real. I'll talk more about that a little bit later. We had one of our last episodes about Halloween and a man that took the life of his child to claim insurance money. Otherwise, a normal person, it struck home, I think, even more so than just a, you know, your Halloween serial killer type story or exorcist type story. It was like, this is just like, shit, someone's capable of doing this? And that's the scary part. Let's continue into the story here of the disappearance of what happened to Susan Powell on the dark side of Wikipedia. Joshua Powell was born on January 20th, 1976, to Stephen and Tricia Powell in Puyallup, Washington. Joshua's parents had a dysfunctional marriage caused in large part by Stephen's disaffection with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as LDS. According to divorce filings by Tricia in 1992, Stephen shared pornography with Joshua and his two male siblings and refused to teach or enforce limits on certain behaviors. As a teenager, Joshua allegedly killed gerbils belonging to one of his sisters and threatened his mother with a butcher knife. He also attempted suicide at least on one occasion. In 1998, Joshua was living in Seattle as a student at the University of Washington. It was there that Powell began his first relationship with a young woman named Catherine Terry Everett, whom he met at a local LDS ward. After the two moved into an apartment together, Joshua became possessive towards Everett. He would have restrictions and limitations on what I could and couldn't do when it came to my family, she later recalled. If I was going to visit them, he had to come too. I couldn't go by myself. When Everett visited a friend in Utah without Joshua, she decided not to return to Seattle and broke up with him over the phone. Joshua then met Susan Cox, a classmate at his LDS Institute of Religion course, during a dinner party at his Tacoma apartment in November of 2000. The two began a relationship and eventually married at the Portland, Oregon Temple on April of 2001. Joshua had a bachelor's degree in business and worked for a number of different companies over the years, while Susan, a trained cosmetologist, took up a job with Wells Fargo Investments after the family's relocation to West Valley City, Utah, a suburb of Salt Lake City. The Powells went on to have two sons, Charles, born in 2005, and Braden, born in 2007. For a brief period following their wedding, Joshua and Susan lived at Stephen Powell's home in South Hill, Washington. Initially, unbeknownst to Susan, her father-in-law, Stephen, had developed an obsessive infatuation with her, which was only inflamed by their close proximity. Stephen followed Susan around the house with a camcorder, used a small mirror to spy on her while she used the bathroom, stole her underwear from her laundry, read her adult journals, and even posted love songs online under a pseudonym. In 2003, Stephen confessed his amorous feelings to a stunned Susan, who rejected him. The encounter was inadvertently captured by Stephen's camcorder microphone. The Powells moved out of state soon after, partly so Susan could distance herself from Stephen. Susan's journal entries and email correspondence indicated the presence of marital discord. There was tension with Joshua over his refusal to attend church services with his family and over his continued contact with Stephen despite his father's ongoing advances towards Susan. Susan's friends also pointed to Joshua's extravagant spending habits and to his extremely controlling behavior towards his wife. Joshua filed for bankruptcy in 2007, declaring over $200,000 in debts. Susan recorded a video in July of 2008 surveying property damage she attributed to Joshua and wrote a secret will that included the statements, "I want it documented that there is extreme turmoil in our marriage. And if I die, it may not be an accident, even if it looks like one." So a lot of these things, you know, when we hear about them being recounted later on, yes, then you can go and say, holy shit, this is a shit show going on in this house. But you have to think at the time, people have ways of kind of glossing these things over or dismissing them. And unless you're, you know, an extremely close friend of Susan or one of them, you probably wouldn't know. You would probably, because most people don't want to dive into the depths of the chaos that would be going on in an extremely dysfunctional marriage that's not your own. You would be like, oh, well, I hope things get better. I'll you know, hopes and what's the saying? The thoughts and prayers or whatever, you know, like I'll just hope it gets better for you, because it really truly isn't anyone else's business. But until it becomes an issue of safety and then other people, then it is others' business to step in and try and help out. But you can kind of see where until she had to literally flee, many probably had no idea, unless you were super close.
Well, I think it's a situation where everything is relative and everybody has problems. Everybody has relationship issues. Really, even the best relationships,
sure,
are difficult. So, his dad has a liking for me. Oh, he just comes around with a camcorder and oh, you know, silly old dirty man. Just steals my underwear out of the laundry. You know, who doesn't do that? That is just odd in its own self. But there are problems. There are relationship issues. There are relationship counselors. I mean, from the outside looking in, you do have thoughts and prayers. You legitimately want it to become better, but you have no way of knowing how truly screwed up it is. But also, I think more real speak, you can't do anything about it. Yeah. And you can't, even if you want to help, even if you want to be a superhero, even if you have a neighbor or colleague that you know she's in a very difficult relationship, you can advise, you can be there as kind of a rock for her to lean on, but you can't be the police.
No.
You can't go in and interject.
And I mean, unless there's like, you know, that there's some sort of physical abuse going on, you know, or some sort of other abuse going on. I mean, all you can do is, you know, if you know that, you can call the police and such and report it. But so many times, you know, the police show up and it's not their fault if they're turned away. If the parties are like, no, everything's fine. They can't like invade the home and be like, well, we're going to sit here and watch and set up our own cameras to make. That's not how that works. It has to be sought out. And it sounds like Susan was trying to do that with her documenting in that video towards the end. But unless, you know, there's that reach out that I got to get help right now, it is ultimately up to the individuals involved or an individual involved to get out, because there are such limitations from the outside sources of, even if you wanted to help, even if you're the parent of one of these people, and if this is your daughter and this is going on, I mean, aside from abducting your own daughter and like forcing her out of the house, which would be illegal in itself, there's only so much you can do, an outside force can do. And that's, you know, it's tragic, but I don't think we really want to also live in a world where one could make a judgment of, this person is bad for you, I'm going to take you out. because that would be abused as well. Certainly there'd be cases like this that could be stopped, but there'd be many where it's like, I just don't like the way that person looks, and then I'm going to steal you away. You know, it would be abused the opposite direction. So, all in all, there really isn't a solution to any of this other than what you've said many times. Don't be an asshole.
It's funny, we talk about this, whether we're talking about a cruise ship sinking, whether we're talking about an airplane going into the ocean, whether we're talking about the old Milwaukeean who killed his friends and then ate them. Don't be a dick.
Yeah.
Don't be a dick. The captain that sunk the ship because he wanted to show off his lady friend. She was up in the captain's quarters.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Let me show you what I can do with this big ship. Yeah, basically it all comes back to the boring, be kind, don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick, exactly.
.com.
Let's continue in to what happened to the story, what happened to Susan Powell and her unfortunate story. On the morning of December 6, 2009, Susan, Charles, and Braden attended church services. A neighbor visited them at home in the afternoon, leaving at about 5 p.m. This was the last time Susan was seen by someone from outside of the Powell household. At first, the entire Powell family was reported missing on December 7th by relatives. Joshua's mother, Tricia, and sister, Jennifer Graves, went looking for the family at their house shortly after being informed that the children had not been dropped off at daycare that morning. They called the police when they failed to make contact with Joshua and Susan. The police broke into the house, fearing that the family might be victims of carbon monoxide poisoning. They found no one inside, but noticed two box fans blowing at a wet spot on the couch. Susan did not show up at her job on December 7th. Her purse, wallet, and identification were all found at her house. Her cell phone was later found in the family's only vehicle, a Chrysler Town & Country minivan that Joshua had been using. Later that day, at about 5 p.m., Joshua returned home with the two boys and was taken to the police station for questioning. He claimed he had left Susan sleeping at home shortly after midnight on December 7th and had taken his boys on a camping trip to Simpson Springs in western Utah. Police visited Simpson Springs on December 10th but found no evidence of the campsite that Joshua had described. They also found it suspicious that Joshua would take his young boys out camping after midnight when he was scheduled to go to work at his job just hours later. Joshua had not told his boss that he would not be coming into work that next day and explained to police it was because he had thought it was Sunday rather than Monday. Upon searching the Powell residence on December 9th, investigators found traces of Susan's blood on the floor, life insurance policies on Susan for $1.5 million, and a handwritten letter from Susan expressing fear for her life. DNA test results released in 2013 matched one blood sample with Susan, while another sample was determined to have come from an unknown male contributor. In August of 2012, West Valley City Police released documents showing that Joshua took actions that were regarded as highly suspicious following Susan's disappearance. Joshua liquidated Susan's retirement accounts, canceling her regularly scheduled chiropractic sessions, and withdrew his children from daycare. He also previously spoke to coworkers about how to hide a body in an abandoned mine shaft in the western Utah desert. Police interviewed the couple's eldest son, Charlie, who confirmed that the camping trip Joshua described took place. However, unlike his father, he stated that Susan had gone with them and she did not return. Weeks after her disappearance, a teacher reported that Charlie had claimed that his mother was dead. Furthermore, Susan's parents, Chuck and Judy Cox, claimed that while at daycare several months after the disappearance, Braden drew a picture of a van with three people in it and told others that Mommy was in the trunk. Investigators informed the media that they planned to question Joshua again and subpoenaed all footage and interviews, aired and unaired, of Joshua from local television stations. On December 14th, Joshua retained an attorney in connection with the investigation, and police said that he grew increasingly uncooperative. A few days later, he took his sons to Pelop to stay with Stephen for the holidays. By December 24th, Joshua was considered a person of interest in the investigation. On January 6th of 2010, he returned with his brother Michael to pack the family's belongings, indicating he was moving permanently. In Fallop, Joshua occupied a home with his two sons, his father, Stephen, his brother, Michael, and Jonathan, and his sister, Alina. Joshua indicated that he would rent out his house in Utah. It was reported that he returned to Fallop after he had lost his job. Soon afterwards, the website SusanPowell.org was launched, described as the official website of Susan Powell. The site's anonymous entries defended Joshua as the victim of a smear campaign and Susan's family, his estranged sister Jennifer, and the LDS Church. Additional posts also speculated that Susan's disappearance was connected to that of Stephen Kochner, a former journalist who vanished the same week as Susan, and that the two had run off to Brazil together. Joshua and Stephen were widely believed to have written these posts. In late 2010, both men claimed that Susan had abandoned her family due to mental illness and that she had left with another man. Susan's family rejected these claims as being unsupported by any evidence. Investigators' scrutiny extended to Stephen Powell upon learning from a family friend that he had been obsessed with his son's wife. Computer images seized from his house in 2010 turned up 4,500 images of Susan taken without her knowledge, including close-ups of specific body parts. Police also turned their attention to Michael Powell after learning that he had sold his broken-down Ford Taurus to a wrecking yard in Pendleton, Oregon, shortly after Susan's disappearance, and had later ordered satellite images of the lot. When police found the car, a sniffer dog indicated that a decomposing human body had been in the trunk. DNA tests on the car proved inconclusive. On September 14, 2011, Utah authorities discovered a possible gravesite while searching Topaz Mountain, a desert area near Nephi that Joshua had frequented as a campsite. There were signs of recent soil disturbance and shoveling, but after digging a few feet down, police were unable to find any remains. In spite of careful sifting of the soil, federal anthropologists also ruled out the possibility of the site being an ancient burial ground. Police continued to examine the site for a time, but offered no explanation as to why they previously announced the findings of remains when none had actually been confirmed. Authorities said they were following a scent detected by their sniffer dogs. Relations between and within the Powell and Cox families became increasingly hostile. After a police raid in their home in 2011, both Joshua and Stephen spoke to major news outlets regarding journals that Susan had allegedly written about the relationship between Stephen and herself. Stephen claimed that he and Susan had been falling in love prior to her disappearance, and he cited the content of journals written when Susan was a teenager as evidence to support his theory that she was mentally unstable and could have run away with another man. A judge issued a permanent injunction forbidding Joshua and Stephen from publishing any materials from Susan's journals, ordering the pair to either return or destroy any journals already published. On September 27, Stephen was arrested on charges of voyeurism and child pornography after police found evidence that he had secretly videotaped numerous women and young girls, including Susan. John Long, Assistant Attorney General for Washington State, said that Joshua was a subject in the child pornography investigation. A friend of Stephen claimed that he was preoccupied with pornography and was hung up on Susan sexually. Chuck Cox filed for custody of Susan's children the day after Stephen was arrested. A Washington court eventually granted Cox temporary custody of the boys, ruling that Joshua would have to move out of Stephen's home if he wanted to regain custody. Joshua rented a house in South Hill, Washington, but authorities later alleged that he had never actually moved into that house, merely making it appear as if he had satisfied the court's instructions while continuing to reside at Stephen's home. In late September of 2011, Joshua's sister Jennifer stated that she believed Joshua was responsible for his wife Susan Powell's disappearance. His other sister, Alina, also had been suspicious of him as well. However, she later withdrew her suspicions and felt that Joshua had been unduly harassed by the investigation. By this time, West Valley City had spent more than $500,000 on the case. On September 28th, Mayor Mike Winder indicated that he felt the case was worth the expense, stating, "We felt that we were getting to that tipping point where we would have more hot evidence than we have had in the past 2 years, and that the case was moving forward." In late 2011, Joshua underwent a series of court-ordered evaluations in Washington. The evaluations by James Manley determined that Joshua had adequate parenting skills, a steady employment history, and no criminal record or history of domestic violence. However, Manley also raised issues concerning the ongoing criminal investigation, Joshua's failure to admit normal personal shortcomings, his overbearing behavior with his sons, and his persistent defensiveness and paranoia attributed to the police and media attention in conjunction with underlying narcissistic traits. The initial recommendation was for Joshua to have visitation with his son several times a week, supervised by a social worker. In the last week of January 2012, Utah police discovered about 400 images of simulated child pornography, bestiality, and incest on Joshua's computer. The images, while not illegal due to their being a hand-drawn and cartoonish 3D format, were cause for greater concern to Manley, particularly given Joshua's earlier denial of possessing such material. Joshua was recommended to receive a more thorough psychosexual evaluation and polygraph test, but Manley suggested to change in the visitation schedule with the Powell boys. Meanwhile, Michael established a Google site page which claims that Susan's parents were abusing and neglecting the boys in collusion with child welfare authorities, and that West Valley City Police had both mishandled the investigation into Susan's disappearance and were harassing Joshua. Lawyers for the Cox family disputed the allegations, and Google removed the site after a few days due to terms of use violations. So, I don't know what it really takes for a law or social worker or governmental intervention, which already was clearly going on with him and his kids, to maybe ramp up the restrictions or say, we're sorry, you kind of violated some shit here. Although I guess, like they said, technically not illegal because it's cartoon bestiality porn and incest and whatever the other fucking weird shit he had on his computer. But I would think that when it just kind of is contradictory to his uber, you know, I'm a super duper, you know, Christian-y type behavior, but I'm really into this shit, and there's a missing wife involved, and you went camping at midnight with your kids, and then your wife's missing. I don't know what else you fucking need to say, I think you might have killed your wife, and maybe we should keep you away from your children completely, before something really bad happens.
Yeah, I don't think you need to wait for the oven to ding to find out that it's done. You have the ingredients, okay? You have the ingredients. You don't need to wait to bake this for 45 minutes to find out, oh shit, it's burnt.
Yeah,
it's not good here. And that is when we deeply dive into these stories and find out how this played out, where there's 400 pictures of some really screwed up stuff. Well, it's cartoonish, so that's okay. Excuse me? These are children's lives that we're allowing this monster of sorts to still continue. And I would imagine, not being a member of law enforcement or an attorney of any sorts, there are certain laws that you have to abide where, from a subjective standpoint, you want to take these children and take them far, far away from this man.
Yeah.
But legal rights and cities and counties and all of those, what have you, you kind of have to walk that line.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it absolutely, he sure as fuck should not be with these kids, even though he's their dad. But I mean, like, there's these things in place to let parental rights, even though they're crappy parents, still have their kids, or at least be able to see them. So that's where it gets. Even though it doesn't make sense, as this played out here, they had to kind of follow the rules of sorts.
In many cases, I think sometimes there's more restrictive laws for owning a pet than there is for having a child.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of welfare and such. And you can argue it, you know, there's certainly people who abuse animals too, but it's utterly insane. And I could never have that job of social worker. I feel for those people. I have some friends who are, and you know, it's not their fault, because again, it goes down to the law. They have to follow the law, no matter how much they would love to say, there's no fucking way you're ever seeing your kids again, you freaky motherfucker with the Bugs Bunny, you know, a cartoon where he's fucking his mother with Jeffrey Dahmer in the background, you know, cutting the heads off of the children that they create. That's a fucked up cartoon. You probably shouldn't be. Anyone who's in possession of that on their computer probably should have their parental rights taken away. And I'm not saying that's what it was, but, you know, I'm hypothesizing, if you will, of the weird shit that somebody like that would find, you know, sexually arousing. I don't know how you do that. And thank God there are people out there who do subject their minds to these worlds of these people and do their damnedest to try and protect these kids. But the law of where we draw the line of saying you are not fit to be around a child needs, I think, some reevaluation. Because far too many times we end up with, well, turned out this person and really was capable of killing their children. It's like, oh, you fucking think? And the big word narcissist came up in that last chapter too. And that's what I was thinking right off the fucking bat, is this is an extreme narcissist. But as I was saying on an episode I did yesterday with Carol about a guy who gave cyanide laced pixie sticks to his children and the neighborhood children. And then his son died and it was an attempt to collect insurance money. That's a special type of narcissism. And it's like a hot fudge sundae, if you will. There's a lot of narcissists out there with extreme narcissist personality disorder, and they're like not capable of realizing the shit that they do. And I think eventually they believe the shit that they say and do is like okay, but you're just a few toppings away from sociopath or psychopath when you're on that narcissistic personality disorder route. It only takes a couple extra, you know, colored sprinkles to make that person the sociopath that they are, where they're capable of killing the wife, then going on and living this normal or trying to appear normal life, and then killing your own children, which is, you know, is unfathomable for all of us. But there's something so wrong, and I don't think it doesn't take a genius to look at this and go, there's too many sprinkles on that narcissistic sundae over there. This one's capable of doing that shit. And when it's not like, oh, you're taking away the rights of someone. Look at the shit they're doing. Look at the shit how they're living their life. It's not like you're just coming down on someone for the hell of coming down on someone. Now, can anything be abused? Sure. But if we're just talking about kind of playing by the rules and looking at the case and going, we got to make a fucking judgment call here. More judgment calls need to be made. There needs to be more judging in this world when it comes to people who fit profiles like this. And less, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. No, we need less of that and more judging when this sort of shit comes to the surface.
It takes some large cojones, though, because if they judge and they judge incorrectly, then there can be a lawsuit. Then there can be credibility that is put into place. And yeah. I don't agree with this, but I'm just trying to give a view of the other, other angle. I'm right there with you, but from a standpoint of being objective, when it's so easy and quite honestly the right thing to be subjective, it's a very tricky situation. Because and you talk about animal welfare and child welfare, all too often in situations like this, there's parents out there that try for years, for decades I should say, there's husbands and wives, to bring a child into the world, and for whatever reason they can't. And then you have people who literally, the guy sneezes on the wife and she's pregnant and they have 9 kids. They don't know what the fuck they're doing. All they know how to do is make children. So there's so many layers that seem so simple, and they seem so transparent. But once you really get into the meat and potatoes of it, it's clear as mud. And it is so ridden with laws and such that
it is.
It's absolutely tragic how it turns out. But sadly, the folks that want to prevent it are almost handcuffed until something actually happens, until a death occurs, until a body is found, when they can only get a warrant and then act upon it to hopefully save yet another tragic event from happening.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, what I'm saying, you know, is like in a perfect world, this would be how it should work, but it's not a perfect world. And everything I'm describing, if done correctly, would save lives and keep people more sane. But unfortunately, everything is ripe for abuse. And all it takes is one person to abuse that system and make false claims or something. And then it's proven that they were false claims. And then suddenly we can't operate by this anymore because somebody's making false claims and people will abuse that system. And then in turn, you're going to end up with this sort of thing. And it's probably why we are where we are. You know, it probably is the reason why there are so many restrictions, and it ends up working in the favor of the abuser rather than the abused because of so-called rights of abusers. And then when that system gets abused itself, and false claims are made, then it becomes so litigious and insane that the abused end up getting abused far more than just by their abuser, than the system almost is abusing them because it's not doing its job protecting them from the abusers that are out there.
What's interesting is when it gets to a point where something occurs and then a trial begins and wanting to prosecute the abuser, that these that are abused, it could happen 5, 10, 15 years ago, they don't want to relive that. So sure, they will basically let this person live the rest of their life as a free person, opposed to having to recount and go through the mental trauma and such. And a friend of mine works in that realm where she basically deals with victims and will say something occurred in one part of the country and this person has moved on, they started a new life, they have a new family. She will have to almost convince them to fly back into the city that it occurred if there is a trial. And basically her sole purpose is to calm them down and to have them focus and say, even though you're having to bring these events back up and make them real, this is for the better. This is to prosecute this person. And she said that such heinous things have occurred to kids that they would rather have these monsters just live free rather than having to go back into that mental state. And that is, that's a situation that I can't even imagine or fathom to be in. Mm-hmm. Something that, okay, you have the opportunity to put this person away, to put them in jail, but you would rather let them be free than have to take 2 or 3 weeks of your life up and to go back to that dark, dark time.
Well, that's where you, and then you get into the world of victim shaming, where it's like, well, why didn't you say something first as somebody sits on their couch and watches the story on Dateline? It's like, well, because it was so fucking traumatic for them, they didn't want to relive it. They didn't want to have to go through the litigious, fucked up system that didn't protect them in the first place. So why would they have any faith in it for a second round that it's going to protect them again, if not put them in more danger by possibly enraging the original abuser to go after them? Not for the first time, but maybe a second, third, fourth, fifth, 10th, 15th, 20th, because they're bringing it to light. They finally escaped and they got away, and you're relying on that system to work its way through and to find that abuser guilty. And in many cases, they can get off on technicalities and things like that. And then guess what? The system says, well, looks like they got off on that technicality. Both of you are free to go and roam the world on your own. And guess what? Abuser goes back and finds their victim, and it can get much worse, much quicker. And you're really rolling the dice if you're the one that's abused and you've found a way to move on as best you can. If you're going to ever go back and say, I don't want this to happen to other people, but I also need to protect myself and my family. And I don't want to be involved in this circle of insanity anymore. And you have to respect that. And you can't shame a person who's going to come and say, look, this shit happened. Now, should due diligence be done and make sure that someone making a claim is legitimate? Of course. You can't just take every single person at their word. There needs to be some sort of investigation to go, okay, yeah, you are legit. I get it. But you can't sit there and criticize someone for not, why didn't you say something right away? It's like, have you ever been through that? No. Well, then shut the fuck up is my answer to that. You should have absolutely no opinion as to why that person didn't say something.
Tony, I'm a little bit confused. Your thoughts of somebody telling something to do when they've never been in that situation before. What would you tell them to say?
Fuck up. If you haven't lived it and you haven't done it, I'm sorry. You don't have a right to judge that person. Now you can say, well, let's look into this more and make sure that the claim is legit. Sure. You can't just say one person can't just make a claim and another person is guilty, you know, just by the claim. There's plenty of people who will make false claims, but there's many cases where it is not a false claim and it needs the attention, and you can't shame people for finally coming out, especially when there's truly nothing for them to gain other than being re-victimized mentally by having to go through it again. That's always the crazy shit. That's always the couch quarterback on things like this. Oh, they're out for money on it. Really? They're not making any money on it. In fact, they're going to go through their fucking life savings spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on attorneys to try and keep them legally safe and any sort of other protection that they may need. So they're going to go bankrupt by going out and saying, I'm going to try and help other people from protect them from this because the system's not doing it. And then they end up being re-victimized by the system itself. So there's a lot of fucked up things. And the answer, they're trying to get money. No, they're not. It's a never ending circle. Let's continue on with the story of Susan Powell and its continued dark path. On February 5th of 2012, social worker Elizabeth Griffin Hall called 911 after taking Charlie and Braden to a supervised visit at Joshua's house in South Hill. Hall, who was supposed to monitor the visit between Joshua and the boys, reported that he grabbed them and would not let her in the door. Soon thereafter, the house exploded, killing Joshua and the two children. Local authorities treated the case as a double murder-suicide, saying that the act appeared to have been deliberate. When authorities notified Stephen, who was in jail, he didn't seem very upset by the news, but was angry towards authorities who notified him. 2 weeks later, Stephen invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to answer questions about the Susan Powell case. Cox and others have stated they believe that Stephen knew what actually happened to Susan. Stephen was convicted of voyeurism charges in May of 2012 in a trial which largely skirted the issue of Susan's case. After a relatively brief investigation, officials confirmed that the explosion had been deliberately planned. The official cause of death for Joshua and the two boys was determined to be carbon monoxide poisoning, though the coroner also noted that both children had significant chopping injuries on the head and neck. A hatchet was recovered near Joshua's body, and investigators believe that he had attacked the boys with it before being overwhelmed by smoke and fumes. The fire investigation also found 2 5-gallon cans of gasoline on the premises, as well as evidence that gasoline had been spread throughout the house. Friends and relatives of Joshua told authorities that he had contacted them by email minutes before the incident to say goodbye. Some of them included his pastor, received instructions about finding his money and shutting off his utilities. Records also showed that Joshua had withdrawn $7,000 from his bank account and had donated it to children's toys and books to local charities the day before the incident. Joshua named Michael as a main beneficiary of his life insurance policy. Charles and Braden are buried at Woodbine Cemetery, which also contains a memorial for their mother. Joshua's remains were cremated. On February 11th of 2013, approximately 1 year after the death of Joshua and his sons, Michael took his own life in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where he had moved for graduate school. He jumped from a roof of a parking garage. Police had questioned Michael several times in 2012 after discovering his abandoned car at the Oregon Wrecking Yard. Michael was evasive about why he left the car at that location. Utah authorities have since said they believe that Joshua and Michael were accomplices in the murder of Susan. In a February 2013 interview, Manley, who had conducted the 2011-2012 evaluations of Joshua for Washington authorities, acknowledged his suspicions that Joshua was involved in his wife's disappearance. However, he did not mention these suspicions in his report because they were beyond the scope of his duties and because Joshua had not been charged with any wrongdoing. On May 21st, 2013, West Valley City Police announced that they had closed the active investigation into Susan's disappearance. Joshua's sister Jennifer wrote a memoir with co-writer Emily Clausen about the Powell family's tumultuous history. The memoir was published in June of 2013 as A Light in Dark Places. Jennifer was inspired to write the book, she says, to help other people to recognize abuse in either their own relationships or relationships around them because it's not always completely apparent. In March of 2015, Chuck Cox won a protracted court battle with Tricia and Elena Powell over control of Susan's estate. Tricia and Elena had sought to have Susan declared legally dead to collect life insurance, but Cox ultimately gained full control of the estate. The Cox family also sued Washington's Department of Social and Health Services, claiming that the agency prioritized Joshua's parental rights over the safety of the boys and facilitated their deaths. While a lower court initially ruled against the Coxes, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reversed this ruling and allowed the case to proceed to trial in January of 2019. Susan's family also pressured state lawmakers in Washington and Utah to pass bills that would restrict or block visitation rights for parents being investigated for murder. Stephen Powell was released from prison on July 11, 2017, after serving a total of 7 years following his voyeurism and child pornography convictions. He died of natural causes in Tacoma, Washington, on July 23rd of 2018. Susan remains a missing person, but given the fates of his sons, it's widely believed that she was murdered by her husband. There are calls as of March of 2018 to have her declared dead, with the cause being homicide. Well, I guess my answer there would be you fucking think. But it's just, it's kind of maddening. You have this insane narcissism, this sociopathic, this psychopathic individual or individuals in this case, the father-son duo that lead to this insanity. And then you have this system that's insanely broken. And doesn't, you know, truly, it doesn't have the ability to do the job that it set out to do. And it ends up in something like this. I kind of go back to that. We were talking earlier about the folks who are, you know, in charge of social work, like the individual who dropped the kids off or was to be there for the visit. They're obviously not at fault. They went there to try to drop it off. Suddenly these kids get ripped into the house and then the damn place explodes. Holy shit. How do you prevent that? I guess the visits don't happen at home. You know, maybe they go somewhere where they can't blow up the building on purpose. But I mean, how do you can't foresee the means to which a determined psychopathic mind will go to do the horrible things that they want to do. The human mind is far more scary than I think almost any ghost story we could ever share.
This, you ever go to a movie and it ends and you're walking out of the movie theater and you turn to your friend or whoever you went, man, I'm really not satisfied with how it ended.
Uh-huh.
Sadly, this is real life, but I'm not really satisfied of how it ended.
No.
There's more to it, and I don't think they're going to bring it back for another season.
No, it is. I mean, it's a simple analogy, but it's true. It's like, why could they not declare her dead? What is holding that part back? You know,
the comfort that you give to her family, the comfort that you give to her legacy as a life. I mean, it's very morbid, but she presumably is no longer living, and you need to give that closure to. I don't know. I can't imagine that presuming somebody dead or officially claiming somebody is dead, that then invokes a lawsuit or life insurance, or somebody is then at fault because they said she was dead, but they don't have proof. I just, it's above my pay grade, but still, I think it needs to be done.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I'm sure the insurance company is happy it sits where it sits because it's less money they have to pay out. But at the same point, it's like, why? I mean, is there something working in tandem with insurance companies? I mean, is that part of it? I don't know. And I'm not making an accusation. I'm just asking a question because to me, it's like, this is pretty cut and dry. She's dead. But why can't we make this declaration so this family, these grieving parents and such, you know, not like they're going to like, oh, great, I get a big payday now. But no, but maybe they could use that money to set up some sort of foundation or some sort of work, you know, for raising more awareness. I mean, on things like this and trying to go down the path of madness of a, you know, like I said, awareness. But, you know, you have to go down that one and go, well, what is awareness? A lot of us, you know, I think there's been at least a point in many of our lives where we could look at someone, whether it be a coworker, whether it be an acquaintance, whether it be a party you were at with people that you really didn't know much about, but you could just tell by the demeanor between that one couple that there's some bad shit going on there beyond just he's kind of an asshole and she's in a bad mood. You know, it's like, no, I think there's a lot darker shit. Not that that, you know, deems, let's call the authorities, but, you know, maybe some that are closer could do something, or there could be more investigative work going on to make sure that everyone's safety is okay. And I know you can do wellness checks and all that, but they only go so far. I mean, ultimately, it does go back. As I say, my mind sits here and it just spits out possible solution, possible solution, possible solution. It spits them out, but none of them seem to stick to the wall. And it all eventually goes back to don't be a dick. And that's the ultimate solution is when we have people stop being horrible people to one another and we don't have these histories of abuse back and forth and then little children grow into being adults and then they end up doing horrible shit to one another and the cycle just keeps going on until that's ever stopped. You know, there really isn't a true solution to a lot of these things. There's no way you're going to have, you know, monitors on every human being to prevent shit like this from happening. But it truly does blow the mind when you hear the lengths to which they've gone to pull off their murderous acts. It's just, you know, it's shocking and it's sickening, but it is the world we live in. And as Hugh Downs...
It's maddening. You know, I'm sorry, Hugh, Mr. Downs, go ahead.
Hear me say Hugh Downs and you shut up. I was going to say, and as Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters would say, this is 2020. Although this stuff happened far before 2020. But so
it's really funny that speaking of all of you 9-year-old fake news reporters, that you fast forward to the year 2020 and you think, yeah, that's awesome because this whole year it's going to be, you know, like 2020 with Barbara Walters and Hugh Downs. I tell you what, this year has been so much of a shit show that if we could just go back to the fun play on words, hey, 2020, oh, cool, you're going to have 2020 vision. Oh, cool, it's going to be 2020, the news story. Fuck that. How about we just move along here of the fucking shit show of a year and we'll be able to do that. It's very interesting. I don't know if you have gotten to a point where there's so many things that happened that we can't even understand. For example, when the first car was built, the first Ford, when it went from horse and buggy to actual cars and things you can't even really fathom because you don't know a life without it.
Yeah.
Have you reached a point, and maybe because you've moved out and a little bit more country and you're not having to deal with as much modern conveniences, but things you yearn for, like, oh, I remember when I went to a basketball game and there were fans. I was rubbing elbows. Oh, do I yearn for a time like that? And not even being sarcastic, where you're literally it's like, man, I remember when we could do that.
Sure.
It was less than 6 months ago. And it's amazing how quickly we yearn for something that, what, you know, it feels like yesterday, but it also feels like 10 years ago. Have you gotten to that point, or are you still in kind of this holding pattern where we'll get back to good, we'll get back to normal?
No, I'm in there. I'm wondering if we'll ever get back to a normal. Mm-hmm. I went out last weekend a little bit thinking, okay, I'm going to go into the city because I needed to go to a specific store to get something for a project that we're working on. And while there, I thought, okay, well, you know, there's a grocery store that I really liked that I thought, you know, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to go pick up some stuff for dinner. And I'm going to try and make it semi-normal, wearing the mask, and hopefully everybody else kind of does the distance thing and all that. And thankfully, I'd say we're at a good, in our area, probably 98% mask wearing. You do have a couple assholes here and there who like to skirt the rules of the giant signs on the doors of every business saying mask required or you can't come in. And so for the most part, it's being done. But you have, you know, some narcissists who like to think that it doesn't fucking matter and they're above everything. But it was just, I was so ready to come home. I was just like, I can't fucking take this. Not only because people, there was a lot of kind of trying to act normal, but it wasn't normal. And so much of like the store was like shut down or like not functioning as I remembered it. And it was just like parallel universe and people just like, it's like, this shit is real. You guys do realize that, right? And I mean, I saw like this mall area that I had to stop into. It was busier than it was like pre-COVID. And like lines going outdoors for restaurants and people not far away from each other. And I'm just like, why is it spreading? Why is it getting worse? Because we're all like, I get it. We're all yearning and trying and wishing and wanting things to be better. I do too. But I mean, if we can't just follow some basic decency rules, and I'm not saying shut everything down. I'm just saying if we want things to be open, okay, great. But then we have to realize the new way of keeping things open is going to look a little different than before. Just putting on a Halloween mask doesn't make it all better. We have to do some things. And it was just kind of maddening, kind of the lack of respect for others' space and such that I was seeing. And then just being in the stores themselves was weird because half the store is empty. It looks like we're going to be hit by a hurricane or something. And it's just like, it was weird. It was uncomfortably weird. And all these things that everyone wants to be normal and I want to be normal too, just did not feel normal. And I would rather not expose myself to that. Like, I think there's almost a certain level of trauma that you get when you go out and everything is so dramatically different than what you remember. That I'd rather remember it how I remember it, and I'll wait the year or two or whatever it is for things to start looking more normal before I go back and visit them. Because then all I think about is just like, what the fuck? You know, how is this going to be normal? But anyway, this is 2020. And I think part of it too is a lot of these things, I don't think we ever fathomed being part of what this would look like. And that, I think, is the more shocking part. I'm someone who likes to sit here and think, well, if this happened, here's how it's going to look. If that happened, here's how it's going to look. Not even talking about the pandemic. But when you think about the pandemic and how it would look, it's not how I pictured it would look. And I think it's not even down any path I thought it would go. So it's just, it's this uncharted territory that makes it so much more uncomfortable for folks that are anxious and have anxiety and all that. But anyway, didn't mean to go down the path of COVID on the program too much, but we're at the end of the episode anyhow. So glad we got to have a little bit of relief from the world of 2020 by hearing about a wife that was murdered and a father that blew up his house with his children in.
Can't we just go back to a time where the social worker shows up to pick the kids up and the house explodes? Man.
Good old days.
With some buttered popcorn from Blockbuster. And hey, don't forget to rewind that Home Alone 2 or they're going to charge you extra.
That wraps up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our show, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts as well. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin. It's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin. It's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin. It's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin. It's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slipcovers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange anytime. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.